welcome to the fourth episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series from Denniston, Sighthill and Hag Hill in Glasgow's East End. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell and I'll be your host for this series. Today, I speak with Alice LeMay of Denniston. Alice is a bespoke tailor whose practice includes both suits and dresses and the sharing of knowledge through community outreach with Decent Projects, a company she runs with her partner Callum. We talk about her path from Norfolk to Denniston, taking in her studies, and how she continued to develop her craft. We also go into the history of tailoring in the area and how much the area means to her. As we recorded this conversation over Zoom, there are, of course, the occasional odd noises and echoes and pings here and there. I've tried to edit them out where possible, but you will hear the odd wee whistle and echo, for which I do apologise. Without further ado, I hand you over to Alice LeMay. Who are you?
My name's Alice LeMay. I'm a bespoke tailor and dressmaker. I live in Denniston and I work a short distance away from Denniston in Bridgeton. I co-run a social enterprise called Decent Projects with my partner, Callum. Generally speaking, most of our activities have been clothes mending workshops in the community, but we've got big plans for the future. So yeah, it's a kind of a varied career, I suppose. But yeah, all sort of linked to sewing. Yeah.
So where are you from originally? Where's, you're in Denniston now, but where was home going back?
So I grew up in Norfolk. Then I lived in London for a while. And then I moved to Glasgow. But I should say in between Norfolk and London, I lived in Edinburgh for 4 years and completely fell in love with Scotland. I'd never really liked Norfolk very much growing up there. The landscape's very flat and uninteresting. And I think I also just didn't really engage that much with the countryside I was living in as a child. So coming to Scotland for the first time, coming to Edinburgh for the first time and seeing sort of what to my mind were mountains in the middle of the city was kind of like a fairy tale. I know, you know, it's fairly trite to say that visiting Edinburgh feels like a fairy tale, but you know, to like an 18-year-old from who'd been in Norfolk her entire life, it was quite stunning. So yeah, and I think I left Edinburgh in 2010 and was just always wanting to go back to Scotland. So sort of finally moved back and this time to Glasgow in 2016.
The correct choice.
The right choice, yes.
I see that as someone who lives on Mull. Norfolk to Edinburgh to London to Glasgow. Mm-hmm. And sewing is the common thread. See what I did there?
Between... Ah, very clever.
No, sorry. When did you start sewing?
When did I start sewing? I started sewing when I was at art school in Edinburgh. I'd been like a tomboy, like from when I was 11, 12 till 16, 17. I had absolutely no interest in clothing whatsoever. And then my sister insisted that I have something that wasn't like an oversized vintage man's pinstripe suit for my sixth form outfit, which I thought was going to be great. And I thought I was going to look great. In hindsight, she was right. So yeah, we went shopping for some feminine clothing and I sort of never looked back really. So when I went to Edinburgh and I was in this amazing city full of like vintage clothes shops and all this interesting culture, I started getting really into clothing and like I would buy vintage pieces and sort of try and adapt them slightly, but I really didn't have any idea what I was doing. And at that point I was very much convinced I was going to be an animator. So I didn't really associate my emerging passion for vintage clothing with any kind of future career. I think at the time I thought of fashion as being relatively frivolous and something that I did as a hobby or, you know, an addiction.
That's fascinating. So why did you think it was frivolous then? I can understand, but frivolous, why?
It seemed unimportant. I mean, at the time I was wanting to be an animator, like making arty animated movies that, and that somehow felt like it had more weight to it. I mean, in hindsight, I don't know that any film I produced at the time and would have produced if I followed that career would have any have any significance or, you know, poignancy for anyone. I think it probably would be equally as frivolous as I viewed fashion to be at the time. But anyway, yeah, it took a while for me to kind of accept that that was what I wanted to do with my life. I remember really distinctly, I was on the animation course and it was like the night before a big hand-in, and I just had no movies. I had no films and no sketchbook work. And, you know, I had like maybe a couple of drawings, but I did have a whole pile of frilly knickers that I'd been making, which obviously I couldn't submit for my animation hand-in. And I was on the phone to my sister and I was saying, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. I haven't got any films. And she's like, well, isn't it obvious? This isn't what you should be studying. I mean, to be honest, I don't think she was ever that convinced by the whole animation thing. But so I kind of needed someone from outside of myself to say, to give me permission to pursue it. And that was a really liberating moment, because I think from the age of 16, I got really into animation and was absolutely convinced that that's what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And it had become like a really strong obsession. And so, and I think also when you're that age, when you're like 19, 20, it seems like if you change direction, not to everyone, but to me anyway, it seemed like if I changed direction at that point, I would be like behind everyone, you know, who had stuck to a path. So I was really conscious of that. I didn't want to like change direction and then have to start all over again. And then, oh God, I'd be 24 by the time I graduated. And how old would that be? And that kind of thing. So things that seem ridiculous now, but were genuine worries at the time. But yeah, so from that moment, I started looking into courses where I could learn like real skills. That was my focus. I really wanted to learn how to sew really, really well, because I was very aware that having taught myself, I was doing things in the most convoluted, inefficient, unprofessional ways. So I wanted to, you know, go in the opposite direction. I wanted to learn my craft. I wanted to become a master of my craft. And at the time, I naively thought that like a degree would provide me with a mastery of the craft of sewing, which of course I've since learned it's not possible. But yeah, that was my hope.
Degrees are just condensed forms of other people's learning. You know, these are the key points, particularly a practical degree. It's about condensing that learning of a profession into a series of attainable points that otherwise would take you a long time to learn. I think that's the thing. So I hate to come back to it, but frilly knickers.
Oh no.
What's the story with the frilly knickers?
Not the frilly knickers. yeah, I can't explain the frilly knickers. It feels like an extended period of madness. I've made one pair once for a burlesque night out, and they were totally mad. I sort of pulled some bits off like a ruff or a cummerbund or something, and they were very much like a hodgepodge of different fabrics, and they were enormous. You know, they were not for the faint-hearted, these frilly knickers. And the thing is, they give you certainly a lot of cushioning if you fell over on a night out, which I of course used to do a lot in the heady days of art school life. So I started making these frilly knickers, and then I made one for myself, and then I made a few more pairs, and I put them on Etsy, and then it just became like a compulsion. But I didn't even really like them very much. That was the thing. I'd sort of make them and sort of stand back from them and go, oh, these are really odd.
But yet they'd sell.
But people would buy them, so it was sort of a confirmation thing. And I mean, yeah, they weren't. So they were very much sort of, I guess, more like performance knickers. I don't know whether people were buying them for that purpose, but you couldn't wear clothes over them. Like, well, you couldn't wear jeans or anything close fitting. They were sort of had sizable pleats on them, ruffles.
Sounds brilliant. I'm seeing Bella Emberg in my head from Russ Abbott's Dancing House Days. But that's fab. That paints a very clear picture for us. Thank you. After Edinburgh, the choice is to go to London. What was the experience of living and studying in London like? Was that what you'd expected? Was it what you'd hoped? Was it different?
Well, when I was first studying in London, I was living with my then boyfriend in Croydon, which, if you've got anyone listening to this, or if you yourself have got any familiarity with London, it's not exactly London. It's sort of South London, and I was living in, like, I guess, quite a domestic settled setup with an older boyfriend. He owned his house, so I was entering fashion college, not feeling very fashiony at the grand old age of 24, living in a much sort of suburban part of London, I guess. And so I guess I didn't feel like I was in London really when I was living in Croydon and starting off fashion college. And I felt quite like old and separate from fashion college. I remember on like one of the sort of icebreaker days, I was chatting to this guy who was also on my course. He asked me how old I was, and I said I was 24. And he's like, 24? What are you doing? I just imagined that the course I was going to would have a lot more like mature students on, and it did have a few mature students, but there were also just a lot of people who were fresh out of high school. It took a bit of adjusting, yeah, I think, to sort of be back in university in a very different context to somebody older, you know, although of course I wasn't that old, but and not feeling like a fashion person, because I felt almost like I'd gone into the course by accident. You know, I'd realized I had this passion for textiles and sewing, but I didn't love the fashion industry. I didn't like worship any designers. I wasn't like engaged with it in that way. For me, it was always more about the skill and the techniques. Yeah.
So what are the skills of being a bespoke tailor? In fact, let's even go further back into it. What is a bespoke tailor? What does a bespoke tailor do?
Well, it's a slightly contentious topic, because there's, you know, in any, I guess, niche industry, which is what bespoke tailoring has kind of become, there'll be people who say it has to be done this way, and other people will say it has to be done that way, or that all these things don't matter. And generally speaking, a bespoke tailor is someone who will take your measurements, cut you a suit from scratch. So like, they won't be using any pre-existing patterns. They'll just use your measurements and draft a suit that fits you perfectly, taking into account all of the eccentricities of your body. I mean, maybe that's the wrong word to use, because it's actually, you know, we all have things that are...
I'm particularly eccentric, I think.
Things that are like asymmetrical or...
Us, they're us.
Yeah, exactly. There is no like... normal body, and I think that's something that I've really learned through what I do. But there, you know, every client I see will tell me that there's something wrong with them, and of course there isn't really. It's just that we're sort of in this mindset from the high, you know, from high street sizes and things like that. But if we don't adhere to that, then we're somehow wrong. But I think it's all the way around, to be honest. But anyway, sorry, I'm
no, that's fascinating to hear. No, that's not. Well, actually, as you speak, I'm looking over your shoulder there, and I can see on one of your mannequins there, there's a dress that's hanging with the pink dress
pink
there. That's extraordinary. You can see the lines in that already. They're not the standard lines of something you'd see on a shop front. There's a personality to it already. There's a stance in the dress there already. So you can see the personality or the physicality of someone already in that, which is remarkable.
Yeah, that's actually, it's something I'm sort of draping. That's a technique where you take fabric. I mean, it kind of is fairly self-explanatory. You take fabric to a mannequin and you just start sculpting with it, I guess, on the form, putting in pleats where you want, and, you know, you can use a pair of scissors, you know, wherever you want, take out fabric, take out bulk, you know, use big basting stitches to hold things in place, put marks on it with chalk and stuff like that. And then you take it down back to the table, pull all those bastings out, you check all your markings, and then you actually sew it together. So that's, I really enjoy working like that because it's sort of much more organic and you get instant feedback about how something's working, coming together. But yeah, I'm going to go back to answering your point about what is a bespoke tailor. So yeah, a bespoke tailor will like draft you a suit from scratch. They'll have an understanding of your body and how to, if you want to correct any asymmetry, for example, if you've got a dropped shoulder, which almost all of us do, you know, a lot of us carry heavy bags, you know, have like a more dominant arm, and that will affect the balance of your shoulders. So, you know, for example, a bespoke tailor can build you up a slightly bigger shoulder pad to straighten you out if you want that. If you've got sort of like a hollow chest, they can build out the padding in the chest. And then the actual process, that I guess that's more where each tailor will have their own methods and where the controversy potentially sometimes comes in, or perhaps not, maybe not controversy, but like debate. But yeah, so the way I work, I work in like sort of a handcraft manner. So I do a lot of hand stitching. The canvas of a suit jacket, which essentially is the sort of the piece in the chest, which gives it its shape and stiffness. I hand quilt it. It's called pad stitching, but it's sort of lots and lots and lots of stitches that give it, you sort of sculpt the cloth as you go, and all the little stitches just sort of pull it into a nice, gently curved shape. So that canvas is attached to the suit, and then I hand stitch the lapels in the same way, sort of putting tiny, tiny stitches in them so that the cloth curls over. I do the same on the collar. So there are ways and means of making those processes faster by using machines, but I don't do that. So that's the distinction between bespoke and perhaps made to measure, or a faster, less expensive service, is that the things that are done by hand are done by machine. So yeah, it's a slightly rambling answer to your what is a bespoke tailor question. But
phenomenal. You can sense from that, you painted a very clear picture for us of the time that it must take. It's a discipline of time and a discipline of sculpting as well, which is, yeah, lovely to hear that. What for you then has been the most difficult build, the most difficult make that you've ever had to do?
Ooh, what's been the most difficult?
And why, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't just do men's and women's tailoring. I also do dressmaking. And some of that is really challenging. So, for example, working with silk chiffon is very challenging. If you don't know what chiffon is, you'll recognize it. It's a sort of very light, floaty, ethereal fabric, and so all those things that make it beautiful make it incredibly difficult to work with. So I made a few silk chiffon dresses not last year but the year before, and that was always challenging. It just takes a lot longer. You've got to do so much more by hand. You've got to kind of, the way I've developed of handling it is sort of, I almost sew it hanging up, like I sort of pin two pieces together on the mannequin,
wow,
and drape together, and then I sew them as they're hanging, so that wow, sort of base them as they're hanging, which is my method. I don't know if it's the right one, but it works for me. Yeah, I don't know, most complicated. I mean, I did some jobs in 2019 that were pretty challenging. I had a bride who wanted a dip dye wedding skirt, which I said yes to, but I'd never done any dip dyeing before. So I had to, maybe this is the most complicated one because it involved building like a dye rack in my bathroom at home.
Wow. So what is dip dyeing? I don't know that process. Is it like tie dyeing?
Kind of. I mean, well, so it is what it sounds like. You are dipping the fabric in the dye, but not the whole of the fabric. So you're dipping it sort of it depends what effect you want, but in this case, just sort of the bottom third of the fabric. and you want like a gradual fade. It's kind of like a sunset effect. So yeah, for that job, I needed to set up, I guess, kind of like a pulley made laundry rack thing. So I built one of those in my bathroom at home, and I lined my bath with plastic sheeting, so it looked a bit like a murder room. And but that was tricky because it was sort of a one shot job. You know, I had the length of fabric.
So stressful.
Yeah, very stressful. I had the length of fabric that I had. It was very expensive. It was a sort of silk. And you got one attempt and that's it. You know, well, obviously, if I wanted to do it again, I'd have to buy all the fabric again. And that would also impact my time that I was taking on the job and all that. So, yeah, I got very stressed about that. But actually, it was fine. It was fine. And, you know, I was just sort of raising and lowering the pulley sat next to the bath while I was reading a book. So in the end, it was actually, the process was quite relaxing. But the anticipation of it was stressful. But yeah, it turned out really, really beautifully. So I guess doing what I do, tailoring and dressmaking, it's slightly unusual. Most tailors will just be tailors, and likewise dressmakers just be dressmakers. So I guess probably the hardest thing about what I do is the variety. And I know that's not perhaps not the answer you were looking for in terms of an example of a specific case, but it's every time I'm doing something different. So, yeah. And each project presents its own unique challenges, which is, you know, really difficult often, but also kind of what I love about it, because I'm not just doing the same thing over and over and again, which I think I would lose interest, maybe. Yeah.
Tailoring, obviously, then has been around for as long as we have been around, really. It's an ancient trade. The knowledge of working with fabrics, working materials, making clothing that has a function. How conscious are you of this line of tailors that you're now continuing on from? And where have you learnt these skills outside of college as well?
Yeah, no, I'm really conscious, I guess, of the legacy of tailoring and my part in that. I think in the past I've been almost felt a little bit kind of suffocated by the legacy, in as much as I don't think that I fit within an established aesthetic or culture of bespoke tailoring. So when you start getting into bespoke tailoring and looking at like blogs about it, or you know, the most significant critics or commentators on bespoke tailoring, there is increasingly a more diverse style presented, but generally speaking, it's sort of it's for men. It has a very sort of a luxury feel to it. It's sort of reminiscent of men's clubs and all of that, which I have no problem with, mm-hmm. and obviously completely makes sense with where it's come from. But for me, that, you know, it would be kind of farcical for me to present myself as like a heritage company, you know, with and put all dark wood in my studio and have a box of cigars and, you know, wear a fancy suit and all this kind of thing. I used to think I should really do that. I used to think, oh God, I should really make myself a suit and I should invest in some incredibly expensive brogues and I should, you know, essentially, you know, walk the walk that I thought I needed to walk. But I think I'm increasingly realizing that actually that's just the remnant of bespoke that's left from a world that was much more diverse. So I've just been doing some research recently into bespoke tailors and dressmakers in Glasgow in the 1960s. And in 1968, initially my friend Raymond, who's a tailor, told me that he thought there were probably more than 30 bespoke tailors in Glasgow in the 1960s.
Wow.
I got a copy of the Kelly's Directory from 1968. And I don't know if all of these are bespoke tailors, but it listed over 150 tailors in Glasgow in the 1960s. Now, some of these might have been alteration businesses, but certainly a lot of them would have been tailors. There were 23 dressmakers, I think. So, you know, what we see today, I guess what I'm trying to say is, in the past, I've been feeling this pressure to adhere to a certain aesthetic that still remains in association with bespoke tailoring. But I'm increasingly realizing that actually, to make more people feel welcome, I should just stay as I am and recognize that what I offer is something different, and that if bespoke clothes making is to become more normalized, that there needs to be a more diverse offering. So it doesn't progress the trade for me to, you know, dress up in a suit and talk about fancy watches. You know, it also doesn't make sense because I'm not interested in fancy watches. So in terms of where I've learned and what I've learned is, since leaving fashion college, that I think I've really had opportunities to learn practical skills. Although I learned a lot of pattern cutting at fashion college, which has been incredibly key to the diversity of what I offer, I guess. But the practical skills of tailoring, I initially learned with a fantastic West Indian tailor called Joe Allen, who's in Islington in London. Really funny character, very generous. And he's got me out of a few tricky spots over the past few years, and just has such a wealth of knowledge. I think he's a fourth generation tailor or something like that, but a lot of his brothers have gone into the business as well, and it's just in his blood, and he's very, very skilled. And he, unlike a lot of tailors, he also does dressmaking. So I think I really like that about him as well, that he recognizes that he has these skills and he can apply these skills to a man's suit or a woman's dress. And for him, you know, diversity is important in his business too. So I think I really like that about what Joe does. And then in Glasgow, I had the incredible good luck of moving to Denniston and and coming into contact with a really lovely tailor called Raymond, who's lived in the area for 50, 60 years, and keen to share his skills. So yeah, I think he found out about me when I was briefly in occupation on Duke Street. I had a pop-up shop for a few months in 2019, and he came in and started chatting to me. And initially I thought he was after work. I thought he was sort of coming and saying, "Oh, what's going on? What jobs have you got on?" And I thought he was trying to get me to give him some work. And I'd sort of come home and say to my partner, "Raymond's coming again. I think he wants some work. I can't give him any work." But it's sort of eventually the penny dropped that he's just interested in it and he wants to talk about it. I think he misses it, which I would completely understand. You know, I know how much I get from being able to talk with people in my line of work. It's really nourishing not to just be in your own little bubble.
Denniston itself has a history of tailoring as well, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first moved to Glasgow in 2016, there was Robert Dick on Hillfort Street. It was run at the time by a man called Jack Houston. It was just fantastic to see a true bespoke tailoring business within 2 minutes walk of my home. It just felt too good to be true. So I did do a little bit of work there for a while, but I eventually had to stop working there because I got some work in a film that was being produced in Glasgow. So I had to go and do that. And then I ended up sort of being caught up with my own projects. But working there, you know, seeing the daily day-to-day running of a bespoke tailoring business, you know, employing three or four staff, was a very different perspective, you know, because I'd always been familiar with independent tailors working on their own, but this was a different approach. And yeah, and all the people there had, you know, been there for 20, 30 years and had huge amounts of skills to share. So yeah, that was really, I feel really privileged that I did spend some time there while it was there, because it's now closed. There aren't really very many true bespoke tailors operating in Glasgow anymore. In fact, I think Jack Houston might say, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he might say that he was sort of one of the last sort of businesses, certainly trading on the high street. So that was, yeah, that I as I say, I feel quite fortunate that I had that opportunity.
Denniston itself, then, what is it about Denniston? Why did you choose Denniston as home?
Well, I mean, I didn't choose Denniston. Initially, like, having studied in Edinburgh, initially when we were house hunting, flat hunting, we were looking in Edinburgh, and then we came over to Glasgow for one day of our week-long flat search. And yeah, my partner Callum had kept finding really affordable, like, spacious flats in Denniston. And I was like, where's Denniston? I didn't know Denniston, because I knew Glasgow a little bit from visiting my sister when she studied in Glasgow while I was studying in Edinburgh. So I kind of knew certain parts of Glasgow, but I didn't know Denniston. And Callum's like, it's in the East End of Glasgow. I thought, oh God, the East End of Glasgow? That sounds really dangerous. And so, yeah, I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed of myself. But that was my thought. But anyway, thought we'll give it a go, see what it's like. And I was amazed how nice it was. Like, I guess I've since learned how welcoming and what a great sense of community there is in Denniston. But I was initially just struck by the architecture, the spaciousness of the streets. Like, we live in one of the drives of Denniston, and then the park, Alexandra Park's up sort of a little bit further up the hill, and it's a really lovely park. You know, it's got these different sides to it. It's got sort of a more Victorian manicured rose garden bit, a fountain, and then it's got sort of a hill, and you can almost trick yourself that you're out in the wilds, and a golf course. And yeah, it's just a really great part of Glasgow. I mean, I'm biased obviously because I've been a resident for sort of 4.5 years now, but yeah, I love it.
You mentioned community there. How has your experience of community in Denniston grown over the years? How have you felt that it's come to be home now?
Yeah, I think I didn't really know what community meant until I moved to Denniston. I know that sounds incredibly cheesy.
But that's going in the trailer.
Yeah, I know that sounds really kind of cheesy, but I used to talk about community, and I wanted to be involved in like community sewing projects, or like setting up a community fashion label. And I had a brief taste of what a community could be like in London when I was working at a maker space, which is sort of like a facility where people can access tools that they might not be able to afford themselves. So I was running like a fashion and textiles makerspace there. And there was a community there, and I had the little taste of like, oh, this is quite nice, sort of being in a group of people who are all very different, but
yeah,
each brings something unique, and that sense of belonging, you know, I had a little taste of that. But yeah, moving to Denniston, it's just made it very real, you know, what the good feeling that community can give you. Yeah, I think I've in the past sort of reeled a bit from the idea of, you know, of being recognised in the street on a daily basis and sort of bumping into people. But now I love it, you know, and I think it takes me some mornings it takes me an hour to walk to work, which is only 10 minutes away, because I'm bumping into people I know and having a chat. You know, and I'll take certain routes to work that mean that I think I'm probably more likely to see Raymond or something like that, so that we might have a chat. So I guess in terms of my efficiency at work, it's probably not that great.
But it's great for your life. It's living a life. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, that's fantastic to talk so much about that. But let's talk now about your social enterprise, about your work, your community outreach work. What is your community outreach company? What does it do, and why do you do it? What was the inspiration behind it?
So the name of the it's a CIC, and it's called Decent Projects. And when we first moved to Glasgow, we had this sort of pie in the sky idea about like taking over one of the old derelict school buildings and filling it with people making clothes with real care, and that being a really pleasant, soulful work that people could take pride in. And you know, we talked about like getting tailors like Joe Allen up from London. At this time I didn't know Raymond, so I didn't realize I had sort of these skills on my doorstep, but we talked about getting in experts and like working with local people, teaching skills and building this amazing community of clothes making. I mean, yeah, I guess at the time I was thinking I needed to build a community when I didn't realize there was one right there.
Yeah, waiting to see you. Yeah,
exactly. So that was initially the plan, but we thought, well, you know, that's a far away dream. What can we do in the local community that's relatively easy, that is sort of a testing ground for seeing what the appetite is like for learning skills and what benefits it might bring? So mending classes, clothes mending classes emerged as kind of like a test. Let's see if people even want to learn how to sew, and if they do, is that a good thing? So we started doing them at the Project Cafe in central Glasgow, and we've since done them in King Park and some in Denniston and all over the place, really. But yeah, it's always free. We're always teaching a broad range of mending techniques. You don't have to have something to mend to come along. You can just come along and learn skills. So we have like scrap fabric and things like that people can practice sewing on. And it's been amazing to see the level of satisfaction that people can get just from performing a simple task and realizing how much competence they actually have. And you know, I know that from my own experience. Some of the most rewarding things I've done in the last 9 months of lockdown have been like repairing my partner's trousers, which has just felt really, really satisfying. So that's been sort of most of our activities to date. We did a project, sort of a community Christmas project in 2017, but most of our activities have been focused around clothes mending. And then in the future, I guess we're wanting to do more clothes making, particularly in the East End of Glasgow, and just teaching sewing skills, other sewing skills like making skills, to a higher level as well. I think we're quite keen on equipping people with skills so that they can approach more complex projects, and you know, the real well-being and sense of satisfaction and pride that could come with that. At the moment, we're also building a directory of clothes makers and designers in Glasgow. So,
cool.
I think we're really passionate about the idea of making clothes locally, and that has been done in the past and could be done again. And we're building an online directory for people to be able to find brands and designers and independent tailors in their local area.
And where can the listener find that? Would that be on your website?
Well, we're currently building it at the moment. It's going to be called Glasgow Made. So it will be at glasgowmade.com. But it's currently being assembled. And I don't want to put too much pressure on my partner and announce the date for when it will be launched, because we're both working on this in our spare time outside of our full-time jobs. So it will be launched at some point this year. We're hoping spring, but Yeah, but the website decentprojects.com, that has all the information about all the projects we've done and all the projects we'll be doing. So we'll be announcing a date, a go live date on there as and when.
Thank you so much, Alice. It was a great pleasure to speak with you, and thank you so much for all your time. I particularly loved hearing how your 10-minute walk to work can take an hour. And that's a real testament to the community. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life. I share the position with my mate Tim Marozzo, who will be taking photo portraits of the people we speak to when COVID restrictions lift, which should hopefully be quite soon. There's 4 episodes out already with people from all sorts of different walks of life which may be of interest to you. There are so many more tales to be told, so if you know of someone like Stuart, Elaine, Mitch or Alice or Irene who knows tales of Denniston, Sighthill or Haghill and you think they'd be willing to talk to us for the podcast, we would love to hear from them. If you wanted to drop us a line, you can reach us on info@tales-fae-the-east.com. We're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Our website, tales-fae-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and an intro to Tim and I and provides links to subjects covered in the episodes. Very soon with this residency, we're also going to be offering photography and podcasting workshops, so please feel free to drop us a line to say if you'd like to join us. We'll advertise these more on social media as we go along. So the most likely thing is that they'll be on Zoom. It's the easiest way of accessing them, we think. One of the subjects we're really interested in is investigating the role of Gaelic in the community. If you're a Gaelic speaker in the area, or if you know anyone who is, we'd love to talk to you. If you know of any interesting Gaelic-related stories or facts about the area, we'd also love to hear about them. There's so many more conversations waiting to be shared with you. I can't wait to get them out to you. Thank you for listening. I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Mórin tang. Hí mírís chiv. See you again soon. Tati bye!